Hello, everyone. This is M.R. Rangaswamy on Indiaspora Radio. Today, we're joined by Dr. Pat Basu. He's a physician, an entrepreneur, an executive, and most of all, a public servant. In 2013, he helped launch Doctor on Demand, the service that enables patients to instantly video connect with a physician or psychologist from their phone, tablet, or computer. He oversees over 1,400 doctors who can diagnose, treat, and prescribe medications. Prior to that, Dr. Basu was the chief medical officer and COO of Virtual Radiologic, which he helped grow into the largest provider of radiology and telemedicine company in the world. Before that, he took a short break from Stanford University, where he was on the faculty, to serve the country as a White House fellow. It's, as you know, an extremely prestigious position. He still continues to play a prominent role in the community and in public service. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, serves on the Board of Health in Illinois. He's also unique in that looks like he's got an MD and an MBA from the University of Chicago. Like I said, he was at Stanford. He's also studied mechanical engineering. Welcome, Pat.
Thanks, MR. Great to hear from you, and thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, terrific, terrific. So you've done a lot in a very short time here, so I want to jump into talking to you now. Take us through your early years. Where did you grow up? Where did your parents come from? How did you spend your childhood?
Sure. Well, you know, as you know, MR, when I was growing up, I only had two choices as an Indian American. Was I going to be a doctor or an engineer? And I had to end up being both. So, no, just kidding. Just kidding. So, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, a suburb called Naperville, Illinois, and had an older brother and a younger sister, I should say. My parents are Bengali, so they had emigrated to the United States from Bengal. A couple of funny stories I always like to tell, and I know we all, as a part of the diaspora, have these. But my parents actually first settled in Utah, where my dad was doing his postdoctorate work at the University of Utah, which I always, although I wasn't born at the time, I always say must have been quite the cultural shock. But my parents speak very fondly of Utah. That's where my older brother was born before my family moved to Birmingham, Alabama. Again, maybe not on the high list of hot spots, you know, that you'd expect. But my father's first job as a chemical engineer was with Amoco, and they had a research facility in Alabama where I was born. And then we moved to the Chicago area where the three of us grew up.
Great. I was wondering where that southern twang was from. Now I know.
It only comes out every now and then.
Terrific. So you grew up in Chicagoland, as they say. And how was the transition from Alabama to Chicago?
Yeah, you know, I'll have to speak mainly through, you know, through the voice of stories, because I was quite young when we moved there. You know, I was about, you know, a year and a half, so obviously no real recollection there. But you know, my parents definitely tell stories of, you know, very friendly folks and neighbors in Alabama. Certainly the weather was an adjustment, but, you know, for me personally, I always considered myself a Chicagoan and a Illinois guy growing up. You know, so we went to, you know, my brother, my sister, and I went to the same grade school, same junior high, same high schools. That being said, you know, I think whether it was Alabama or even in the suburbs of Chicago, you know, being an Indian American, you know, first generation, you know, a lot of the same adjustments that I think you go through. It's not as if we had, you know, tons of first generation immigrants in my schools growing up. Frankly, that's changed considerably now. Naperville, which is part of DuPage County, is actually one of the largest homes to Asian Americans in, I believe it's a percentage, it's up there in the United States. But when I was growing up, it was, you know, still pretty homogeneously, you know, white America. And, you know, I have a lot of funny stories of the, you know, the first day of school and, you know, pronouncing names and a lot of those kind of, you know, funny, Yeah, I always joke about my last name. There's only four letters and two syllables, but the amount of ways that Basu can be pronounced or mispronounced is always endearingly funny to me. But no, I think, you know, the adjustment for my parents was quite welcome, with the exception of the weather, and for the three of us in my generation, we loved it. You know, we're diehard Chicagoans, from the sports to the food. So yeah, terrific.
Great. So how did you end up with being an engineer, then going and becoming a doctor, and then getting your MBA? Walk me through the thinking and how you thought about your journey here.
Sure. Well, you know, as you know, Amara, the stories are always a lot cleaner, you know, when you look back. And okay. I always refer to this great Steve Jobs quote about, you know, the dots are a lot easier to connect when you look retrospectively, you know, instead of prospectively. But that being said, I had a very embarrassing moment a few years ago. I had the honor of being recognized by my high school in Naperville as a kind of a distinguished alumnus, and they flashed an article from my senior year of high school, which said, what do you want to do when you grow up? And it said, you know, be a physician, be a leader of physician, and help basically, you know, help transform healthcare, you know, in healthcare systems. And I said, geez, I'm not as exciting as I pretend to be. You know, if I could predict where I was going to be as a senior in high school, I'm not quite as mysterious as I hoped. But the truth of the matter, Amar, is a couple of things. I got some very, very good advice. And it's one of the reasons I'm a grateful, very grateful member of our community. But at a larger extent, it's why I do a lot of mentoring, why I do a lot of public speaking, is because I am a great beneficiary of, tremendous advice and mentorship from, you know, people in my community. And my older brother was one of the first people who said, you know, Pat, you think you want to be a doctor. You're not sure yet. But the reality is you don't have to study biology just to, you know, to go on to medical school. Frankly, you can study whatever, you know, you're good at, whatever you're passionate about. And it's that cliched but very true advice about doing things that you like, doing things that you're good at, mm-hmm. was very true for me. Mechanical engineering was, I loved math, I loved science, I was pretty good at it, and frankly loved space. I loved designing everything from aircraft to, you know, the makings of a space shuttle and things like that. And so that was really sort of a passion of mine. And and the way the story kind of happened is another principle, I guess, is that a lot of my advisors, when I started in college at the University of Illinois, which has a great engineering school, they said, well, geez, you know, it's a very rigorous engineering program. I don't think you can be a pre-med or you can be an engineer, but you can't do both. And I also had a lot of good mentors who said, hey, you know, a lot of people during your career and your life are going to tell you that you know, you can't do things, but, you know, I love the quotation that limits, like fears, are often just illusions. And, mm-hmm. It really worked out beautifully in the sense that I was able to be passionate about engineering, to perform well. And then, frankly, as I became a little bit older, you know, I was still finishing college, and as somebody on the flip side who interviews med students now, I'm always surprised when somebody can plan out their career that far in advance at such a young age, and I certainly was not an exception to that rule. But I was a little bit more prepared to say that mechanical engineering was a solid foundation, but that my core principles of what I wanted to do were to, I loved people. I've always been very, very gregarious, and I loved science, and medicine was certainly one of those applications where you got to do that. But what happened after that, MR, I think is a little bit more interesting. Is I came to med school with the goal, truly, of, you know, every med student has it, of helping people, and as they say when you interview them, I'm sure I said the same thing, but really doing it one at a time. Mm-hmm. But engineering really teaches you, as many of your listeners know, and as certainly as you know, beyond just the basic science, it has this framework that once you've gone through it, you you really can't get rid of it. And I always joke that it's great for me professionally, it's bad for me in my personal life, but the mantra from engineering for me is look at everything in the world and see how you can make it better, right? It was always how do we make the plane fly faster, how do we make the bridge stronger, how do we make the car more fuel efficient as a mechanical engineer. And I found myself in the medical world, MR, at the University of Chicago, you know, one of the nation's top hospitals, and everywhere I looked, there was room for improvement. Every single corner, I found myself asking, geez, there has to be a better way of doing this. And a lot of the tool set, or rather a lot of the problems, I would say, that I noticed were either operational or certainly business, you know, business administrative in nature. And that's kind of what prompted me to say, if I'm really going to be able to improve this system, which is my goal, then there's a certain skill set that I need. And that's this MBA skill set. And you said it in a very kind and endearing tone when you said, you know, he has this MBA, but you definitely start to get some strange looks. You know, it was, geez, you know, you're a mechanical engineer, and everyone on the engineering side says, hey, why are you leaving a great profession to go into medicine? And the people on the medical side are saying, hey, why aren't you a biology major? And it's, again, the similar phenomenon kind of kicked in where people said, hey, you know, you're a fantastic doctor. Why do you want to, you know, the idea of doing medicine and business in the year 2003 was not as common as perhaps it's become, you know, 13 years, 12 years later. And people sort of looked at me and they said, you know, I'm not sure you're doing the right thing. But again, because of the advice and the mentorship I'd had, it was sort of a don't be afraid to carve your own path. Mm-hmm. And that combination, MR, really went on to define, you know, I'd like to think, and you were very nice by saying I'm not very old, I don't think that I am, but for the last, you know, 12 to 15 years, everything that I've done has really been at the intersection of these two disciplines of, you know, medicine as the core tenet, but business as sort of the application of that. I really have become a huge proponent of interdisciplinary skill sets because, yes, it gives you a certain credibility. Sure, it gives you the ability to communicate across both fields. But most importantly, it allows you to see around corners that other people just haven't seen before because you've seen it from both views. And, you know, I have a lot of just kind of funny anecdotes of the intersection between those two. But I always like to say, and it's easier to say this now, but the last company I was leading, we took care of about 8 or 9 million patients a year. My current company already we're doing, you know, we've already touched, call it, 1 million patients per year. And I said, I went to med school with the goal of helping one patient at a time. And because of some of these principles, I now have the privilege of being able to help, you know, millions of patients at a time, with the caveat that you need people to be doing both. You need people who are, you know, the ones that, like my brother, who's a day-to-day excellent physician who still practices every single day. But for me, MR, this sort of macro goal of really impacting healthcare, not at the level of a single patient, not at the level of 100 patients, but probably my lifetime goal, I can easily say, is to make healthcare better for 50 million people around the world, or maybe more. And the MD and the MBA, that sort of skill set really enabled me to embark on that pathway.
Got it. Terrific. So how did you then, Pat, end up at Stanford? What took you there?
Yeah, what took me there is a variety of things, and I'm not entirely joking when I say that the weather and the climate had something to do with it. And as much as I love Chicago, there is something to be said about walking out in the 80-degree sunshine and running through the mountains. But it was really a combination of things, MR. The first is I had a mentor who was a chair of pediatrics at the University of Chicago, and you know, he always had these very pithy sayings, and one of them is that he told me, he was my mentor and advisor, and he said, Pat, in statistics we talk about reversion to the mean, and that's true in life as well. We revert to the mean, and Pat, you always want to surround yourself by the best. It makes us better. And
yeah.
And at the time, Stanford's radiology program in particular was, you know, it's hard to say to pick one program as the number one program, but it was hard to argue that it was certainly, you know, not in the top, you know, in the top line there. And it was that combination with the fact that, you know, gaining diversity, and I just spoke to you about sort of a diversity of skill sets, but simply a diversity of experiences and a diversity of things that forces you to stay on the sharp part of the learning curve is I think a pretty healthy balance. I think some people can take it too far, but some people don't take it far enough. And I think that change of pace, that change of scenery, you know, not just in career but also in life, forces you to adapt, forces you to expand, forces you to grow. And the combination of, you know, going to the, you know, the great program at Stanford, you know, to further, frankly, my career goals, that ability to enjoy, you know, a new setting, and really to pursue the dreams that I had. I think Stanford has a very good philosophy, which is we don't really care what you do. We just want you to do it with excellence. And really a culture of fostering what you're good at. And what I mean specifically there, MR, is for a lot of doctors, particularly in academia, it is their institution sort of puts them into a box that says, hey, you have to do this kind of research and you have to do this. For me, I had started to develop these talents at the intersection of medicine and business, at the intersection of medicine and policy. And if I can say so without being immodest, is, you know, I think I developed some leadership talents and leadership skills that were, I don't want to say unique within medicine, but at least generally not the norm. And Stanford was a place, MR, that looked at those skill sets and said, hey, you know, this is a young physician with leadership skills. This is a young physician with business skills. Let's take him and let's let him thrive, as opposed to, frankly, what you know, I've been asked to help lead some other healthcare centers. Other healthcare centers will sometimes try and kind of beat that out of you. Stanford, I really got the vibe that said, hey, you know what, he has some unique talents that we can foster, and I felt that, and it turned out to be very, very true. You know, what happened at Stanford for me really allowed me to thrive in some of those other areas that I was passionate about.
Fantastic. Well, folks, don't go away. We're going to take a short break and talk to Dr. Pat Basu some more about his White House experience and what he's doing these days. Hello again, everyone. This is M.R. Rangaswamy with Indiaspora, and I'm back with Dr. Pat Basu. So, Pat, you just finished up on how you went to Stanford, but then you get picked as a White House Fellow. So how is that like, moving from the beautiful Bay Area to Washington, D.C.? Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's definitely a huge geographic change, but for me, MR, that was just it was the biggest professional change that I could ever imagine. Despite what I walked through with my career, for the most part, particularly when you're in a discipline like medicine, you tend to get slotted into these tracks. You, for the most part, you know what you're going to be doing, not just 6 months from now, not even a year from now, but frankly, sometimes you know what you're going to be doing 2 years from now. You know where you're going to residency, where you're going to fellowship, where your first job as an attending faculty is going to be. And one of the great things about the White House Fellow process was it took me out of my comfort zone in every way possible, which is something that I encourage everybody to do. Just from a professional perspective, I always say, it stretched me sort of one degree of freedom horizontally and two degrees of freedom vertically. What I mean by that is, you know, it took me a degree of freedom horizontally in the sense that I was used to science, I was used to medicine, but wow, here I was, you know, going for the highest level of policy and politics, certainly not something I'd built my career around. And so it was a horizontal step in that direction. And what I mean about two steps vertically was, again, this is sort of, it's a process that's notorious for being the best of the best. I mean, you're talking about, you know, thousands of people in their 30s and 40s, mid-career leaders, all who have been anointed or recommended as sort of the, you know, the top of their community or the top of their field. And it's one thing to go to med school or business school or some of these things, but just the level of, frankly, competition was unbelievable. I mean, to put this in perspective, by the final round, the remaining 30 people, there was something like 4 or 5 Rhodes Scholars. There were 2 Olympic gold medalists. There were, you know, a couple of Navy SEAL commanders. You know, I mean, probably between the 30 people, there were 70 graduate degrees. Just a really incredible process. And I'll tell you and your listeners, because it's the truth of the matter, I looked at myself a couple times during that process and I said, boy, what am I doing here? You know, it really forces you to for the first time in a reasonably successful career to look inward and say, geez, you know, do I really belong here? And so that feeling, I think, is something that all of us, you know, particularly young folks, I think need to experience, certainly during that career, their careers, that feeling of, geez, am I really pushing the envelope? And so MR, it was a year-long process, went through, you know, 50, 60 interviews through the course of 4 rounds. I, you know, the types of questions I got in the final round in Washington, D.C. is I had a former cabinet secretary ask me, it was the time of the economic crisis, should we go back to the gold standard to tighten the economic standards? And then right after that, a senator asked me, Pat, I read your memorandum to the president. Given the amount of healthcare costs and spending, don't you think we should cut Medicare off at the age of 75? You know, just obviously trying to see how I would respond to the president. You know, one of the president's close advisors asking me a very sort of spiritual, existential question, and it really forces you to speak intelligently and articulately on a range of topics. And it also forces you to be very introspective, because there's only, you know, in my class, you know, 12 spots from around the country that they're giving limited resources to have you work at the White House. And they really want to know that you're going to, you know, the mission of the program is to train future national leaders who are going to have a national impact. And so, they don't want to hear you simply say, Pat, in 15 years, I'm just going to be, you know, leading my academic medical center or doing something like that. They really want to hear the courage of your convictions to say that my goal is to improve healthcare for 50 million people, or frankly, my goal is to be the Secretary of State or, you know, the governor or the president of a nonprofit that fixes education or healthcare for millions of citizens. They really want to know that you have that kind of that vision. And so, MR, the geography change was one thing, but the political change was, you know, you go from being an academic position to working at high level White House politics and Washington politics is an adjustment. But it was definitely the inflection point in my career professionally and frankly from a personal perspective as well.
Fantastic. And that's a great segue into my next question, which is about your current role doing telemedicine. So can you speak a little bit about how you got involved in getting this company going, what some of the problems are and challenges are in kind of getting into this sort of medical practice? You said you touch 1 million people this past year. You know, what is this all about? Can you how did you get into this, and where does this take you?
Yeah, so it's a great segue to your questions in the sense that I spoke about sort of my overarching mission, at least my professional mission, that idea of making a macro level impact on improving healthcare for millions of people, and I should also mention that, you know, policy was a tremendous avenue for me to be able to do that as a White House fellow. And as you mentioned in your introduction, it's still a part of my goal is to work as a public servant. And that has many definitions. But a lot of my colleagues have asked me, are you going to return to working and running an elected office? And I have a lot of friends who I've said, yeah, I certainly haven't ruled that out. But I think the ends really have to justify the means there. And the, if the end goal is to improve life for as many people as possible in a tangible way, then as a professional, you have to ask yourself, what allows me to do that most effectively? And I share that story to say that, you know, I considered remaining in the White House. I even considered running for high U.S. office in 2012 with, you know, some of the close advisors that I had met during my time at the White House. But I took a different path because currently, given some of the gridlock in Washington and in politics in general, I didn't feel that I could have as big of an impact. And telemedicine within the sphere of healthcare, MR, in my opinion and shared by many others, is one of probably five or six avenues that says, boy, you know, access and quality and cost are not antagonistic to each other. In fact, we can improve all three simultaneously. And telemedicine, which I'll broadly define as the delivery of healthcare from a location other than the doctor being right next to the patient, can do all of that. And, you know, the company that I was the chief operating officer for, MR, was actually the merger of two public companies. And I saw firsthand that our costs were literally not a marginal improvement. They were 3 to 4 times more cost-effective for patients and for the system in terms of access, as defined by speed, as defined by ability for people in certain geographies to get care, was tremendously higher. And in terms of quality, we could get the patient to the right type of doctor. So to give you a tangible example, instead of having a general radiologist read your brain MRI because he happens to be the doctor next door to you, we could send your MRI to a neuroradiologist who would read it better, who would read it faster, and who would read it, frankly, much more cost-effectively because, I'll give you kind of a technical term here, but that, you know, the capacity utilization is higher. The amount of time that a doctor spends doing clinical work in telemedicine can be increased because we can fill their queues, which correspondingly cuts out waste, which allows us to charge less dollars. So specifically what Doctor on Demand does, MR, is it allows a patient to video connect literally instantly, you know, in a minute or 2 minutes over their phone, tablet, or computer for traditional things that you would go to the urgent care for. So we can treat sinusitis, urinary tract infections, pediatric sore throats, and things like that. And the beauty of it is we can treat literally 17 or 18 of the top conditions that patients go into the ER for. And if I give you some price points, the average cost of an ER visit in the United States is roughly $2,000. Wow. An urgent care visit is about $400. Even a regular doctor's office visit is, you know, $100, $150. And the cost of a telemedicine visit is $40. Jeez. And again, you're getting it for $40 instead of an order of magnitude higher. You're not having to travel those distances. You're not having to wait the average 3 weeks to get a doctor's appointment. And at the systems level, it frees up my capability and that of my colleagues to be able to spend time in person with the cases that need it. So I would say that telemedicine has the potential to be one of those solutions, one of those four or five that's good for patients, good for doctors, good for the entire system at large, and not just from my academic mind or from that of a policymaker, but you know, I've got a lot of evidence, you know, as an executive who's leading this effort to show that this is indeed true. And I'm definitely very excited about it. And it's not even a future tense. I mean, we have now, you know, millions of use cases that basically say that, yeah, this lowers costs, it improves access, and it certainly can improve quality.
Great. Well, I wish you all the best in this effort because I think this can make a huge impact on the healthcare system as we know it. Pat, I want to move on now to your personal life. It looks like you do so many things. You do keynotes. You're part of so many different groups. You're a mentor, and you stay busy with your current company as well. What do you do to relax?
Yeah, you know, I probably like you, MR, and a lot of other people is that, you know, sometimes people say, geez, you know, do you ever sleep? Do you ever? And the bottom line is I joke, you know, I am try and be one of the most relaxed and fun-loving guys there is. So for me, One thing I will say, especially if there's any young listeners out there, first thing I'll say is I get a lot of sleep. There's a lot of people who say, oh, you must be one of those guys who, you know, you'll sleep when when it's all done, or you sleep two hours a day. And I say, no way. As a doctor, I would be remiss if I didn't say, get your sleep. You know, the human body has a lot of healing methods, so I get that 7 hours of sleep per day. But for fun, I love people, MR. I just love, interacting with people. So I a lot of social activities that I blend with everything from, I love to travel, so I'll travel with, some really good friends of mine domestically, internationally. I still love sports. I play in a couple of basketball leagues and volleyball leagues. My sister and I, we started doing triathlons a couple of years ago. Love to read. And what I try and do, MR, is I try and put a conscious effort towards blending my buckets. So I'll give you an example. If I'm going to speak somewhere, in San Diego or in New York or in Atlanta, I try not to make it sort of, hey, I'm going to just speak there and hop on a flight and come back, but rather, hey, reach out to my friends or family or former colleagues and say, I'm going to be in town and I take a couple of extra days and I'm coming for a work objective, but let's have dinner, let's go out and see the town. And yes, obviously that you can only do so much of that, but when you look at that analogy or what you described as, boy, do you have 48 hours in a day? No, you don't. But I think really being intelligent about keeping people at the core of what I do and making sure that you're always keeping your personal life and your spiritual life and your emotional health ahead of everything else is important to me. So for me, sports and reading and travel and just anything that involves people keeps me happy, keeps me relaxed. And if I didn't do that, then everything else would certainly fall apart.
Boy, I'd love to have your lifestyle, Pat.
And you know what's funny? I'd love to have yours.
So I have to ask you another personal question. So who do you call for medical attention?
Good question. Yeah. Well, you know, Amar, I would not have great Indian parents if the following two statements weren't true. Number one, despite having two of their sons as physicians, my parents still not only do they kind of discard what we have to say and they'll ask us what we have to say for medical advice, but then they'll make sure to get a second and third opinion. But nobody knows medicine better than my non-physician mom and dad when it comes to what to eat or, how often to do this and that. But in reality, all those jokes aside, MR, I will say this. I was in a pretty good habit there of not sort of treating myself or not letting my friends curbside me for some time. And in the last couple of years, I've fallen into the trap of just, having my friends, look at me for something or even diagnose myself. And so I need to get back to, frankly, just getting myself a good primary care doctor who's looking out for me on a holistic level. And so I'll take your little cue here as a reminder that I need to get back to being a good patient myself.
And then one last question before we let you go is to tell us something about yourself that nobody knows.
Ooh,
put
good
you on
question.
The spot. Yeah.
Lots of good ones there. Well, if I wasn't doing these things that you were kind enough to put into, I think, a positive light about my career, I think there's three things that I would love, that they're childhood things that I still have a great passion for that I don't know how many people know. I love space, as I mentioned before. So, my love of, I can recite statistics and all sort of esoteric facts on space and planets and the stars. I never outgrew my love of dinosaurs. So the same thing goes about, maybe being a paleontologist in a future life or things like that. And the third thing is, I love sports, as I mentioned to you, and I catch myself commenting so many times on sports that everyone from my parents to friends and family say, you really missed your calling as an ESPN Sports Center anchor. And I think that would be one of those other professional jobs that I'd love to have. That I'd love to trade places with them for a week or a year or a couple of years. So I don't know if that fulfills your question, but
no,
that would definitely be one.
No, that's great. That's great, Pat. It was a pleasure talking to you, and we'll meet soon, I'm sure. And ladies and gentlemen, today's show is produced by Monica Patel. The theme music is by our very own Rena Ismail. So long, everyone.
Thanks, Amar.